Hello, it's Thursday, October the 14th, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Pizza and beer, they go together. What about pizza made from beer? The huge breakthrough for the government in the row with the European Union over the Northern Ireland Protocol and whether we can sell sausages and processed meat in the province. But first, those intensely irritating people from Insulate Britain have paused their campaign for a week. What a pity they don't pause it for good. So just over a month after their first road locks brought chaos to motorways, Insulate Britain have announced they're suspending their current campaign until October 25. Members of the group could now face jail for their protest blocking motorways throughout Britain, and they've been told they'll be served injunction papers by High Court enforcement officers over protests in recent weeks. Joining me now is Insulate Britain spokesman Cameron Ford. Why are you suspending it? What's going on?
So we haven't heard from the government yet. We sent a letter to them in August, and so we're going down to Downing Street today to deliver another letter.
Right.
And we're giving them some time to reflect on that, and hopefully they're going to come back with some action, because we're just not seeing enough action on reducing CO2 emissions at the moment.
Did you really think a government was going to respond to people breaking the law?
I mean, historically, civil disobedience has worked. It gets the conversation in the public. You wouldn't be speaking to me without this. So now what we've done is basically we're driving the audience to see that the government is 95% likely to miss the 2 Celsius target, according to Chatham House. And at 2 Celsius, at 1.5 Celsius, the island states will disappear. So it's quite serious that 95% likely to miss that. So it's given us a platform to talk about that from. Whether the government gives into our demands, we need the public and your audience to put pressure on, saying, I'm sorry, government, but you've entered a suicide pact with us, and that's not good enough.
The trouble is, Cameron, the public and this audience don't like what you're doing. They think you're lawbreakers, you're endangering lives, you're preventing people from going to hospital, you're preventing people from having cancer appointments, preventing people going for job interviews the other day, preventing lorries with HGV lorries getting through when we know there are already supply shortages. I mean, we've seen the polls. The latest one, what was it, 73 or 74% fundamentally disapprove of your tactics.
I mean, in a couple of decades' time, you could fundamentally be saying exactly the same thing about the levels of disruption about the government, because if inaction happens, which we're on a path to right now from the government, we're going to be sitting in days of traffic just to get medication and you know, finding the local supermarket that's got some supplies. So what we're doing is trying to hold the government to account for their absolute abysmal lack of action. So their Green Homes grant, if I could just talk about that, because the government keeps saying, well, we're doing £1.3 billion worth of Green Homes grant. So the average retrofit cost per house, which is needed to fully retrofit a house to bring it to the standard that it's needed, is about £26,000. So £1.3 billion will do one in 560 homes, which means it's going to take 560 years to get all of the homes to where they need to be. And that's not counting houses that are being built today, which just on Channel 4 last night, there was a piece about how leaky these new homes are and how poor these new homes are going to need retrofitting themselves. So we're just trying to shine a light on the absolute catastrophe that the government is creating.
How much do you estimate it would cost to have insulation in every home in Britain? How many trillion is it?
Sure. So it depends on the house. It varies from, you know, something like 7,000 or 8,000 to do basic external insulation up to about 26,000. It's averaged at about 26,000. That includes low carbon heating sources and other such measures as that. We've linked in with other industry professionals, and we invite other industry professionals to get on board and show the government how this needs to be done. We've just opened up a platform, and now we're talking with other industries about how
what
they
is
can
the cost,
inform the government.
Cameron, what is the cost?
It's a lot, but the cost.
Well, can you
not,
tell me what the no? Well, Cameron, why don't you tell me what it is?
What's the cost on not acting on?
No,
the CO2?
Will you answer the question? You're conducting this campaign for a mass insulation of the country. Do you have a slightest clue what it's going to cost? And if not,
yes.
Why not?
I do. I believe it's about 600 trillion.
You're absolutely out of your mind. 600 trillion? Where's that coming from?
Sorry, 600 billion, sorry.
You haven't got a clue, have you?
I do, I just made a mistake.
Well, let me tell you, one of your spokesmen came on another show I do and said it would be closer to £2 trillion. You're saying £600 billion. But, there's a big difference there of 60%.
I'm sorry, Andrew. I don't know. I'm just doing...
How can you go on any interviews and not know the proper cost?
I am a carpenter who's trying to run a business and secure my future.
Well, so I think you should... I think if you're going to front...
Yeah. Well, I'm not fronting it. I'm not fronting it. You called me asking for an interview.
Yeah. Well, you are a spokesman. You are a spokesman for Insulate Britain who is utterly clueless about how much your demands will cost the country, which is the taxpayer, by the way.
Okay. Well, ask Letty, who are releasing, I believe, this week, a retrofit guide for London. They have better info on this. We are creating a platform. We are creating a shining the light on government failure. That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
Talk to industry professionals, okay? There's a whole wing of Insulate Britain that's talking with industry professionals. I'm not part of that, so I can't speak on that.
I think you're amateur hour. That's what I think you are. You haven't got a clue what this is going to cost, and yet you're going to Downing Street for these demands, and you don't have the slightest clue what it would cost the taxpayer.
Look, your job here is to undermine us. I understand that.
You've undermined yourself, Cameron, I'm afraid, by not having the slightest clue of how much your demands will cost. Not the slightest clue. You're undermining your cause, as you do every time you put people in front of cars and block people doing their daily business and block ambulances going about their work. You're undermining it.
Well, I do know the figures on that. It's that the 1.3 billion Green Homes grant is going to do one in 560 homes.
All right. I think Cameron, I think we've done.
I think we've done, Cameron.
Can I give you some advice next time you do an interview?
560 years to retrofit the homes in this country.
Yeah,
fine. Over 8,000 people die every winter in the meantime.
All right. Yeah.
That's
all right, Cameron.
Not good enough.
Can I give you some advice next time you come on a program? Check your figures and check your facts. That was Cameron Ford, another hopeless spokesman for Insulate Britain. So it looks like Britain is winning the so-called sausage war with the EU over post-Brexit trade this week. Proposals put forward by the European Commission would see 80% of checks removed on goods moving from Great Britain to be sold in Northern Ireland. This comes, of course, only weeks and months after the European Union said that the Northern Ireland Protocol was fundamentally not up for renegotiation. John Stevens is the Daily Mail's deputy political editor and our former man in Brussels. John, it's got to be plaudits for Lord Frost, our Brexit negotiator and the Brexit secretary, who seems to have pulled off an extraordinarily good deal so far.
Yeah, I think that's partly because he's played such hard ball with this. You know, when people have said the EU will never agree to these different things, he's kept pushing. And they've been threatening that if they don't get what they want, that they will trigger Article 16, which means suspending parts of the Brexit agreement they agreed with Brussels. So I think because they've been so firm with the EU thought, well, hang on a minute, we need to try and work out what possible ways can we make it work better for people in Northern Ireland.
And they would have been within the law to have invoked Article 16, because that says you can do that if there's a severe economic threat, basically, and there was going to be serious economic consequences in Northern Ireland, not least in the south of Ireland too, if the stalemate continued.
Yeah, and the British government say that they think they've met the threshold for being able to trigger that.
Yeah.
But I think for the time being, they're deciding not to do that. Because if they did, you know, that would be a massive move. I think you would see the EU retaliate, possibly putting tariffs on British goods. Then we could end up in some sort of trade war. I think it would also stoke tensions in Northern Ireland. I think if there's anything the government doesn't want, it's kind of start messing around and disturbing the peace process.
No. Now, the big sticking point currently then, because the 80% of regulations which are being swept away is a huge plus for the government, but the big sticking point is, will the province of Northern Ireland continue to be regulated by the European Court of Justice? Now, Lord Frost says no. I would have thought that might be a red line for the European Union, and listening to traders in Northern Ireland talking about the Northern Ireland Protocol, they seemed intensely relaxed about the European Court of Justice. What do you think is going to happen there, John?
I think this could be all a bit of a kind of game that it looks like Britain is getting almost everything it wants from the EU. And now, you know, the day before the EU put forward their proposals, suddenly you heard Lord Frost talking about the ECJ and how that's so important. I think that's possibly because he didn't want it to look like we'd got everything we wanted, but he wanted it to look like we were having some sort of battle.
Yeah.
But I think when it comes down to it, they'll find some sort of fudge that the ECJ will still have some role, but they're bringing some new dispute panel, some arbitration.
Independent
panel.
Arbitration.
So I think they'll find some way of working around it while keeping some role for the ECJ. Then both the EU and Britain can claim victory and then get on with it.
No doubt, though, this is a huge climb down by the EU, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. And you kind of look at the big issues over the last few months. There's been the threat that you'd be able to not have sausages crossing from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. We've heard concerns from the Jewish community in Northern Ireland that they've been able to source kosher food. You know, there's been massive disruption for traders, loads of customs paperwork. You see the EU are saying they're going to halve that paperwork, but they're going to get rid of loads of checks on the goods. So I think it is a massive win for Britain.
And the Irish government, clearly behind the scenes, must have been lobbying for a compromise because their economy is hugely dependent on trade with Britain.
Yeah, and I think on all of these things, everyone quite likes a bit of a spat in public. But
yes.
I don't think it works for anyone to have a total breakdown in relations. I don't think Britain really wants to trigger Article 60. I certainly don't think the EU wants it to.
I just find it, John, I see a former aide of Theresa May. Of course, she had a calamitous time trying to get her appalling Brexit deal through the Commons, defeated three times, saying that Lord Frost had won by playing hardball. He's a seasoned diplomat, a former ambassador. And of course, he's popular in the government because he's no threat, because you can't have an unelected lord as Chancellor of the Exchequer or Foreign Secretary. So that's why everyone's singing his praises today.
And he's got a good track record. You look back at when we were signing the Brexit deal,
yeah.
A lot of people saying, oh, we don't think it's ever going to happen. He did find a way to make that happen. And I think people in government are quite optimistic that he's going to be able to repeat that again.
Perhaps when he's sorted this out, he can then sort out the supply side problems in our supermarkets.
Yeah, that would be a thing.
There's a thought. There's the Daily Mail's deputy political editor, John Stevens. Thanks for joining us. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at ToryboyPierce. Rishi Sunak has tried to reassure shoppers that there will be presents under the tree this Christmas amid fears that supplies of toys, electrical goods and other products are going to be disrupted by log jams at UK ports. Some retailers have reportedly offered Christmas discounts a month earlier, calling the move prudent to mitigate the HGV driver shortage and the chaos at the ports. I'm joined now by Ewan McDonald-Russell, who's a policy advisor for the British Retail Consortium. Ewan, the problem with shipping in particular, it's global. I've seen images of huge tankers languishing offshore in the United States, the same all around the world. But the problem in this country has been exacerbated by the shortage of HGV drivers.
Absolutely right, Andrew. This is an international issue to do with the way that supply chains across the world are completely integrated. So things like manufacturing plants in the Far East not producing enough semiconductors resonates through the whole supply chain. And there was a bit of a mismatch between what I think manufacturers thought the recovery would look like globally and in fact what it has. There's a much bigger demand. So that's created a huge kind of challenges in shipping and a kind of quite stretched system, as of course the whole world is coming out of this huge pandemic. So this is absolutely an international thing. The British dimension, the bit that's really tricky here, is that we've got a real challenge of HGV drivers. We're about 90,000 drivers short of what, you know, the industry requires. That's feeding through. So all the stories we're seeing in recent weeks, the challenges on supermarket shelves, the fuel shortages or the fuel not being a petrol station issue, and of course now that it challenged that Felix did, these are all the symptoms of that underlying problem.
Now, a lot of toys that will come this Christmas will come from China, of course, and there are big problems, I understand, to do with China and container ships.
Yeah, so the whole kind of manufacturing type, particularly toys, which are kind of one that I think we all notice at Christmas, because every year there's a certain sort of toys that become terribly popular,
yeah,
and people really kind of go for that. So the idea that there'll be a little shortage of certain products happens every year. So I don't want to over-exaggerate that problem. What I guess I would say is that this is quite sustained, but also that retailers have been aware of it. So this isn't something that our members have woken up to a couple of days ago. They plan Christmas, you know, 6 months in advance. So they're always looking at alternate shipping routes, alternate sources, trying to find ways to get things here. And certainly, you know, as an international comparative, our retailers and members are really agile and as good as they get at doing these things. So also we're worried about disruption. There's also a huge amount of work going to minimize that, because Christmas is the most important trading time of the year. I think we've all been honest about that.
Yeah. And now, do you think, I mean, people listening will be thinking, oh, you know, Christmas presents. Christmas was a bit grim last year. What is the advice of your consortium? Should people start Christmas shopping right now, or just carry on like they might do normally? Perhaps, I don't know when people do their Christmas shopping, perhaps later November or December. What should they do?
I mean, I'm one of these terrible people whose Christmas present spreadsheet starts in early September, so maybe I'm bad for giving advice.
Right.
Normally, we would always encourage consumers to start shopping early anyway for Christmas, to make sure you're not rushing at the last minute, to make sure the exact thing you want doesn't happen. So we're giving that advice again, but that's not just because we've got disruption here. It's always sensible. It kind of spreads it out a bit, and retailers of course want to try and get customers to come and buy items early too, so that's, it's not unusual to say that. I guess what we'd say this year, it's more likely if you leave it late, you might find it really hard to get exactly what you want. Your choice is limited, and that's really what we're seeing from how retailers are responding to HGV shortages. It's not that there won't be any products at all, that's not going to happen, but the number of options, the different choices within a category might be a bit more limited. There might be three types of mince pies rather than 12 types of mince pies.
Yeah.
There'll still be mince pies, but
exactly.
You don't get all the options.
And why do we need 12 types of mince pies or 12 types of brandy butter? I mean, how much of this stuff gets chucked in the bin after Christmas anyway?
I mean, in terms of the surprisingly kind of large amount, people do buy a lot more kind of around this time. We all eat a little bit more than we all hopefully go to the gym in January and try and deal with the consequences of it. So we do see a big volume uplift from this month, to be honest. Christmas spending does generally start kind of October to December. That's the golden trading quarter for our members. So you know, it's not unusual for that. I would just say this year, being a bit organized, being on top of it, particularly also with online sales too, just to make sure that you're not rushing at the last minute.
I was just going to ask you just finally on that, and you mentioned online. Do you detect there will be even more people buying online this Christmas because they may be still worried about COVID? They may not want to go on public transport. They may not want to go into a crowded shop.
I mean, so it's sort of slightly hard to say if we're comparing to last year, because there were so many different lockdowns last year.
Yeah, there were.
Worries about lockdowns last year, that it's a sort of anomaly. I mean, I think online shopping was up at about 65% of non-food shopping at one point. So this year, compared to sort of 2019, 2018, yes, I'd expect more people to be online shopping. About 40% of digital, of kind of non-food sales are likely to be online. That's partly just a trend. It's partly that nervousness. It's also convenient. We've got used to it, to be honest.
Not me. I'll be doing the shopping in person, wandering around John Lewis and all my favourite stores. What about you? Will you be doing more online or more direct?
Bit of a mix of it. I tend to do friends and family are very much online purchases early, but the ones for my wife and for the puppy are definitely in December down on the high street. It's the best place to find the things that she really wants.
Absolutely right. That's Ewan McDonald-Russell, who's policy advisor for the British Retail Consortium. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So it's that point in the programme when we talk about matters to do with the city. Ruth Sunderland is the Daily Mail's business editor. And Ruth, yet more energy companies have gone under.
That's right. And what's making matters worse is we've just been hearing from EDF, Electricité de France, who is one of the big suppliers in this country, saying that it isn't ready to take on customers from energy firms that have gone bust. So this is how this kind of rescue was working. You know, so when companies go under, Ofgem, the regulator, would appoint one of the big companies as a supplier of last resort. And now those bigger companies are saying, well, actually, hold on a second. We've got a problem just taking on new customers to our own books, partly because they're not particularly profitable customers for them. So, yesterday we had a couple go under, as you say, Pure Planet and Colorado Energy were the latest ones that went bust. It's all due to sharp rise in wholesale gas prices. Now, EDF, this is just taking one example, they've taken on about 220,000 customers from another one that went under, Utility Point. And it's also taken on 360,000 from Green Network Energy. And its boss is holding his hands up and saying, well, hold on a minute. You know, can we really just carry on taking on more and more customers? It's obviously a big strain on its systems. And, you know, it's a lot to do in very short order. So we've got a lot of chaos on the energy market and no real sign of that calming down. I mean, if anything, the opposite.
And so what will happen, Ruth, if another company goes under and the big companies that have survived, companies like British Gas and EDF say, we don't want them, where do people go to get their energy?
Well, I mean, that's a very, very good question. I think what probably will happen is that Ofgem will try to just arm twist the larger energy firms into doing that and come to some sort of a deal with them, because clearly you can't have people with no electricity or gas supply. You know, that's got to happen. So Ofgem is saying that it can direct a company to take on customers from a supplier that's collapsed. Obviously there'll be discussions about that, but there's a lot in that word direct, isn't it? Does that mean force? What's behind that? It's very interesting, and we haven't really been in this sort of territory before. Of course, people thought it was marvelous when we had competition, much needed competition, coming into the market, but now we're seeing the downside of that. Almost 2 million households in the UK have now been affected by energy firms that have gone bust. I think about 10 have gone bust since September this year. So it's a real spate of collapses, but really serious big problem here. British Gas, for instance, they've taken on around 440,000 customers. Octopus Energy's taken on 580,000. E.ON taken on loads. So there's a really big moving around of that kaleidoscope in the energy market there now.
Absolutely. And I'm one of British Gas's new customers. And you know what, Ruth? I switched to get away from them in the first place. What can you do?
So, I mean, what can happen as well is the government has got powers. The government can appoint, it can really go into a sort of a quasi-nationalisation on a temporary basis if it comes to an extreme. But, you know, you're right. I think there are a lot of people out there who are disappointed because they're all urged to shop around and look for a good deal. And then in your case, you end up where you started. But this is very worrying for people looking at some large increases in their bills and also being asked, you know, we all want to save the planet, but we're also being asked to pay large amounts through our bills to finance the green energy transition. And it's all just adding up to a lot of money coming out of our pockets.
Certainly is. That's Ruth Sunderland, who's the business editor at the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. Pizza and beer, natural bedfellows. But what about a pizza made from beer? A Yorkshire-based firm is making pizza using grains left over from brewing beers. It's eco-friendly, and they claim it's healthier and, very importantly, tastes good. James Sturdy is the managing director of Sturdy Foods and the Homemade Pizza Club. James, so what you do, I understand, is grains left over from brewing beers, that's 250 million tonnes, you're utilising and putting in the pizza mix. Can you explain more?
Yeah. Yes, Andrew, I mean, that's correct. So it's a waste product for the brewing industry. And as you rightly say, there's 250 million tonnes a year that go to either landfill or to animal feed. And our business supplies into wholesale into the pizza market. And over lockdown, we just had a look at new ideas, new revenue streams. And our idea was to try and launch a pizza that had an improved nutrition profile. And a little bit of research later, and we came across the idea of the spent grain. And rather fortuitously, we actually have a brewery next door, so we were easily able to go and ask for some spent grain and develop a pizza that's partially made with the grain. What we found is it's not only when we sent it off for nutrition testing, it had a much better nutrition profile compared to a regular pizza base. But it also tasted fantastic, and that was the main thing for us, was creating something that had a better nutrition profile, you know, was going to be healthier, but also tasted great. And as an added bonus, obviously it uses a waste product of another business as well. So yeah, we're very pleased with the product.
Now, the obvious question, the grain, which is discarded from the beer making process, is it alcoholic or is it non-alcoholic?
No, it's completely free of alcohol. So by the time the grain's gone through the process, the sugars, the carbohydrates and the alcohol have gone into the beer. And actually what you're left with is a very nutrient-dense product. So, you know, it really is a shame to see that go to waste or go into animal feed, when really there's no reason why it can't go straight back into the human food chain.
Well, I think it's a clever idea. Now, the beer pizza, 22% less calories than a standard pizza base, double the fibre, 20% less sodium, 14% more protein, and you haven't compromised on taste or flavour. What varieties do you make with the beer grain?
Well, I mean, we manufacture a sourdough base, which on its own is a healthier way to make pizza anyway. And then with the spent grain pizza, what we do is substitute some of the wheat flour for the spent grain, so it's made up of 50% wheat flour and 50% spent grain. And as you've just outlined, the health benefits are quite considerable, and we were amazed actually when it came back from nutrition testing as to how many benefits there were. The whole move towards the food industry is one away from what we call HFSS products, which is high fat, salt and sugar.
Yeah.
So, you know, all businesses are going to be forced to deal with this at some stage. And, you know, we wanted to be ahead of the game and try and create a pizza which fell out of that high fat, salt and sugar bracket. And the key thing to achieve that is increasing the protein and the fibre content. And what we found is with the spent grain is very naturally high in fibre and protein. So, yes, a very, very naturally easy way for us to be able to reformulate the product and get the result we wanted there.
And where do you are you supplying supermarkets in Yorkshire or restaurants, or how do people get these pizzas?
Yeah, I mean, our core business supplies into the hospitality market, and over lockdown, that market was quite badly impacted, as we all know. So we launched a couple of other ideas, actually, and business models, and one of which was where the new spent grain pizza is being sold, which is called Homemade Pizza Club.
Yeah.
So you can order online. It's a pizza kit format, which uses a sourdough base. And what we intended was that it's a way of people being able to make pizza together as a family at home, very little mess, no stress, and help to make pizza part of a balanced diet. So it's www.homemadepizzaclub.co.uk.
Right. And you've just got to hope that people keep drinking lots of beer in Yorkshire so you can continue to get your spent seeds.
I really can't see that being an issue.
And tell me, James, is this unique to Yorkshire? Are you blazing the trail here?
Well, as far as we know, we're actually unique in the country we're the first to market with a commercially made spent grain pizza. So there's actually examples of pizza, I've got pizza on the brain, people making beer from leftover bread, but we sort of switched it the other way. So we're making bread product from beer. But as far as we know, it's the first commercially available spent grain pizza product out there.
And when if they're sold in a pub or a restaurant, how are they billed on the menu?
Yeah, I mean, actually, the market for hospitality tends to be a little bit more conservative. So as yet, it's not gone into to that level of the market. So at the moment, this is an exclusive for the e-commerce brand for people to buy at home.
I get you, but matter of time surely before you get it into restaurants and bars.
Yeah, we're certainly looking at the education sector, which is a big focus, especially with the National Food Strategy's recommendations on improving nutrition in schools. So, you know, these are the challenges as a business that we're really interested in. Is how do we, create products that people love eating, and people will always love eating pizza, but how do we reformulate them and be able to make it a healthier choice for people?
Very interesting. And what's your favourite pizza, James? What flavour?
My personal favourite is I agree with the Italians on this. I think if you've got a good base and a good dough, then really you don't need much more on it. So I would plump for a margarita with some nice buffalo mozzarella, some fresh basil, a drizzle of olive oil, and I don't think you need any more.
I'm licking my lips in anticipation. It sounds great. Well, it's a great idea, and I predict, James, it will take off in a big way, and best of luck to you. That's James Sturdy, Managing Director of Sturdy Foods and the Homemade Pizza Club. So you can find that on the internet, the Homemade Pizza Club. Thanks for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.